Product Stacks is brought to you by Storyblok, one of the world's fastest growing headless CMSs. A headless CMS like Storyblok separates the back end from the front end. By moving to an API-based CMS like Storyblok, you can publish your content to any front end, whether that's your marketing website or directly inside your product. Developers love Storyblok because they can use it with any front end framework they prefer and create components that can be reused anywhere as content blocks, cutting development time in half. Content teams are excited about the discussions feature built directly into Storyblok's visual editor. No more Slack or email threads to discuss content changes. Join 86,000 developers plus companies like Harvard Business School, Adidas, Netflix, Oatly, and Pizza Hut who all use Storyblok by trying a free demo at storyblok.com/departmentofproduct. Go to storyblok.com/departmentofproduct. That's Storyblok with a K at the end, /departmentofproduct. Joining us today, we have Vic Bharadwaj from Wayfair. And Vic is a senior product manager at Wayfair. Thanks very much, Vic, for taking some time out of your day to talk through your product stacks with us. Should we kick off with a little bit of an introduction as to, you know, who you are and your background?
Yeah, absolutely. Firstly, Richard, thank you for having me. Definitely a pleasure to be sharing back with the community of the product folks. I've gained a lot from some of the podcast that you guys have put out already and just the larger product community. So just super excited to be here and help the product community out.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, my name's Vic. I moved to the US in 2013, been in the product space for about 7 years now. I currently work in Wayfair as part of the mobile apps space. I'm a senior manager for products here, and I'm responsible for increasing our retention through engagement as a lever that we sort of drive. I'm also responsible for the lower funnel conversion. So things like optimizing our lower funnel in terms of PDP cart and checkout, specifically for our Wayfair US, iOS and Android apps. But I also have the global portfolio of the four geos that we're in, which is Germany, Ireland, UK and Canada.
Awesome. So it's always interesting to know, like, how did you get into products?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah, you know, I funnily enough call myself like an accidental product manager, which I suppose is true with a lot of folks who are in product right now. So I actually, like, you know, when I came here to the US in 2013, I got my MBA at Purdue. And post my MBA, I started working with the Whirlpool Corporation as part of what's called as a global leadership development program. It's a 3-year rotational program where you sort of like move from one organization to another, but you're very focused on like digital products and programs. So my first role was actually more of a digital program manager, where you're sort of like shadowing a product person who's sort of driving the business outcomes and the customer outcomes. And then you're sort of responsible for the how and the when and sort of bringing all the stakeholders together and making things work. And then as part of that program, I got super excited about, you know, it's great to be part of defining the how and the when. And I think it's important that you have some good experience in that to expand your execution muscle. Because execution is a big part of product. But then to me, I've always sort of been in the space of like defining the why and the what. And that's what sort of got me intrigued about like moving into the product space, because as a product person, you're sort of taking a very ambiguous problem or an opportunity and sort of breaking it down into specifics of, you know, what you want to accomplish from both a business and a customer perspective. So I made the request at Whirlpool to like try out a product role as part of my second rotation, and they were more than happy just based on some of my performance in the first role. And I then had the opportunity to work in, and at that same time, Whirlpool was going through a massive transformation in terms of being a D2C company. So we were launching our e-commerce capabilities on Whirlpool.com and Maytag.com. So I had the opportunity to work on the cart and checkout side there as a product manager. And then I moved eventually into the Internet of Things space in Whirlpool, where that's where I dived into the world of mobile apps. So I had the opportunity to launch a mobile app in the US, Canada marketplace, also transform a mobile app. And since then, I've just been in love with the mobile app space and just the journey of the mobile experience. And yeah, and even at Wayfair right now, I'm still very much in the weeds on the mobile app side of things.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, thanks a lot for your background. So many of the PMs that we speak to come from such a wide variety of different backgrounds. And we often get asked, you know, what is the best way to get into product? And there isn't really a straightforward answer because of that, because so many people, I think if we were to kind of say that there's a general trend, the general trend is that most people start off in a tangential role and then transfer across once they've got some degree of skills in other business areas. So it's interesting to your own personal experience And it's interesting to hear that you know, you've spent a lot of your career as well in mobile apps, because I guess that's quite a distinct space in itself when it comes to product as well, because it's, you know, there's a lot of unique challenges and opportunities in the mobile space that perhaps you wouldn't be exposed to in other parts of product management. And I guess that's one of the reasons why we like product management, because an API PM is so different to an e-commerce mobile product manager and so on. So it's good to hear a bit more about your background and your passion for the mobile space as well. Perfect.
Absolutely.
So before we delve into your products, what we thought we could do is just take a bit of a high level view of your overall product process. So yeah, three core areas: roadmap and strategy, your individual team setup, and then finally your software development process. So maybe if we kick off with your roadmap and your strategy process, how do you decide what goes on your roadmap? Do you have roadmaps, and how do you decide, you know, what your strategic decisions are?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yes, we do have roadmaps, but if I back up a little bit, the way this sort of works within the Wayfair context is, obviously at a very senior leadership level, I would imagine like at the C-suite level, there are some strategic priorities for the company in terms of like our long-range goals, 3 years or 5 years, and that sort of trickles down into what's our 1 year and 2 year plans. That sort of acts as the guiding principles for us to sort of tackle. And based on that, we have a structure called as STOs, which is single-threaded owner. So we have close to, I want to say, somewhere like around 30 to 40 different STOs within Wayfair, where that owner is responsible for that particular organization. So based on the leadership strategic priorities, each STO comes up with their specific priorities, and that sort of then trickles down into each product areas in terms of what our roadmaps eventually end up with, right? For the next 6 months, we as a company plan in terms of two cycles. We call it P1 and P2. In fact, right now we just wrapped up our P2 planning, which is the Q4 and Q1. And our P1 planning is Q2 and Q3. And that's one way, right? But as a company, we are also very, very, very empowered for bottoms-up thinking. While a lot of what I just talked to you about comes as more of guiding principles and strategic priorities, in terms of how we get there, what should our roadmaps be? What are some of the opportunities to go after that align with those strategic principles or strategic OKRs? Is very much empowered for like atomic teams and PMs and teams to sort of go after. So I think it's a great mix of having some level of guidance and direction from like senior leadership, but also each team and each product team sort of being empowered to come up with our own roadmaps for 2 quarters at a time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how does the process at Wayfair compare to other companies you've worked at?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like one difference I see here at Wayfair, especially in comparison with some of the other companies, is I think in a lot of the other companies, it's very much a top-down approach where you almost end up being more of a feature factory of sorts, wherein somebody at the leadership level has sort of decided, here's our strategic priorities and here's what we're going to do, and almost defined at the level of here's the feature we're going to ship out. And that's mostly because like, such companies are even trying to catch up with some table stakes sort of features, and it makes sense to go after. But I think with where we are, Wayfair as a company is very uniquely positioned as the market leader in online furniture. So we're always a few steps ahead in terms of competition too, which means we are at the liberty of being empowered to come up with innovative ideas and innovative opportunities to sort of go after. So I genuinely do feel like each team can use those strategic principles and OKRs to guide their roadmap and product priorities. But we're very much empowered to be able to come up with a roadmap in itself.
Okay, excellent. And so in terms of your team setup, we've got like a standard template here, but how does your specific team compare to this? What are the main roles that are in your team?
Yeah. So I think before I get into the specific roles in the team, I think the way Wayfair teams are structured is very methodical. I mean, we call them healthy atomic teams. So the atomic refers to a small team that is capable and empowered to make customer and business impact.
Did you say healthy atomic teams? Is that what you said?
Yeah, that's correct. Healthy atomic teams. So the interpretation of the word atomic is to keep the teams as small and finite where they can operate independently to be able to make business and customer impact. And the word healthy here refers to how do we ensure we have the right people with the right skill sets at the right capacity and structured in the right way to be able to, again, be independent and yet be collaborative in the process of generating business and customer impact, right? And that with that principle, the way we're sort of organized is we've got every, these atomic teams are called as squads. Squads layer up to pods, and each, like there may be multiple pods within an STO that I was saying, like single-threaded owner who has a single-threaded organization, right? So STOs lead to pods leads to squads. So I'm a squad owner for the mobile app team, and my team is specifically called as the app experience team. So within my team, so I'm the product manager on the team. Like you've rightly pointed out here, I have two UX people on my team. I have, right now I have 8 developers, and then that's expected to be 10. So usually at Mayfair, we have a ratio of, I would say, anywhere between 1:7 or 1:8 in terms of PM to dev ratio. And we recently moved away from quality analysts or quality engineers per se, because we believe in shifting left in terms of quality, wherein we want quality to be a culture rather than a process.
Yeah.
And quality to be top of mind for everybody on the team, not just one person. As a QA or a QE. Yeah, I mean, all engineers are empowered to be focusing on things like unit tests, code coverage in terms of automation tests, integration tests, contract testing. And folks like PMs, XD, and engineering managers are empowered to actually like do manual testing as well to make sure the customer experience is good. So going back, like I said, there's one PM, usually 7:8 engineers, 1 or 2 UX people. We also moved we moved left in terms of analytics, wherein initially every squad used to have an analytics person dedicated or shared. But right now, again, PMs are responsible for the analytics per squad. Of course, if something is super sophisticated and complex and it needs some advanced level of analytics thinking, we can always reach out to the centralized analytics team to get some support. But PMs are sort of expected to own the analytics side of things.
Okay, perfect. And in terms of your software development process then, so how do you, what kind of development process do you run in these squads?
Yeah, so we follow Agile and Scrum methodology here. Sprints are on 2-week sprints, and we follow all the regular rituals like daily stand-ups, grooming, scoping, planning, retro meetings, which are pretty standard. And yeah, I mean, we use Jira and Confluence as like our tools for managing some of the Scrum processes.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, we had one person join us who loved Jira so much that they would use it for their personal productivity as well. So they would use it for their own task management.
So, oh, wow. That's pretty intense.
Yeah. I mean, I think with Jira, people usually fall into 2 different camps. They either really like it or they absolutely hate it. But
yeah,
I don't know. What camp do you fall into when it comes to Jira? Maybe you're in the middle. I don't know.
No, I mean, I'm a pro Jira guy. I mean, I've always used Jira. I think there's so much familiarity of the tool. Whichever company you go, there's a high chance that you're going to be using Jira. And engineers like live out of Jira, and there's like a lot of integrations with like Git and GitHub and you know, things like browser stack and stuff. So it just makes life super easy with a lot of the detailed processes that we need to run.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, perfect. So yeah, thanks very much for taking us through your overall product process. That's been really helpful just to kind of set the context. Shall we now take a look at which products you've chosen as part of your product stack? Should we start with your first product?
Yeah, so my first document that I sort of wanted to share today was what we call as the product review document. So think of this as a document that PMs usually spin up when they think about new features or new enhancements that have material impact to the business outcome and the customer outcomes that we go after. So as part of a PM's role, you know, it's super important for you to think about the why and the what we're going after. And that is what we sort of try to outline in what we're calling here as the discovery process. And once you have a good solid understanding of the why and the why, then you start to dive into the how and the when, which is sort of what we talk through in the delivery aspects of this document here. So I'll go through both, but really quickly, the first thing we try to focus on with regard to any new idea is like, what is the, we like to describe new features or enhancements in terms of like, what is the mission we're sort of going after? So this kind of becomes like your headline of explaining to folks, like, what is the idea that you're going after? But then we sort of like really dive quickly into what is the specific user problem or the opportunity that we're going after. And this is a blurb that we usually represent from a very customer's point of view, saying, here's Sally, I'm such and such a demographic. When I use the app, this is a constant problem that I run into because I have to do these XYZ things, and that becomes a friction point for me, right? So I'm kind of just giving an example here, but that's sort of the context in which we talk about. And then to just make it even more specific and crystal clear, we try to represent that in terms of like, what is the exact job that the user is trying to solve for as part of that problem, right? So we try to represent that in terms of like, when I get into a certain situation, I want to do X, Y, and Z, which is my motivation, so I can achieve A, B, C, which is the outcome, which can make me feel 1, 2, 3, right? Because at the end of the day, we're in a space that offers products for people at their home, and home is such an emotional space for folks. And we want to make sure the process of buying furniture is emotionally fulfilling when consumers eventually buy and get the product delivered, right? So that's where we bring in the emotional aspect of what problem are we going after and how our solution sort of ties back to that problem. Yeah, and like I was initially saying, we follow a process called as OKR, which is the objective and the key results. And we try to represent that objective in the form of hypothesis, which is like if-then statements. So, you know, this is representing the hypothesis, like if we do this, then we expect this to happen because we believe these things to be true. And those, because we believe these things to be true, sort of become part of our assumptions that we expect to be true for this hypothesis to hold true. And we kind of list out those assumptions. And then in terms of key results, this is where we sort of have very qualitative metrics all the way from like business metrics, product metrics, be it activation engagement, or any sort of like metrics that we're sort of targeting. It starts with like a North Star metric and then a primary and a secondary metric. We also look at certain negative metrics and neutral metrics that we need to be thinking about. And then we sort of start thinking about like in terms of what are some of the first order principles, right? I think this is super important as a product person. It's always good to have like, what are the 4 or 5 principles that will hold true with this hypothesis and the assumptions that we're going after, and maybe even potentially the solution option that we're starting to think about? Because I think a lot of the leaders work through principles, a lot of the stakeholders think through principles. Even for you as a product person, thinking about it from the lens of principles help align your problem space and your solution space a lot more easily. And then we also look at second order decisions, right? Like for instance, if I think about solving for this problem, what other decisions will have to be taken into account for us to holistically think about this, right? I mean, I don't want to do something on the homepage of the app just to make the homepage good, but what if it hurts conversion, right? Or if I want to do something in PDP, it helps increase conversion, but maybe my finance attachment rate with credit cards or my home services attachment rate is going down, right? So we want to be very thoughtful about thinking through like the second order decisions as we think through like the opportunity space as well. So we try to like categorically call that out here. And because we're such a global company and we're across multiple channels and multiple brands as well, we try to talk through like the MVP version of this. What brands are we testing this? What regions are we testing this? What customers are we testing this with? Like, is it both B2B, B2C, right? So those are some nuances for us as a company. And then like, what are some of the pages that this is going to get impacted? So some of the page owners can sort of be reminded of and brought in as stakeholders. And then we start to think through like, how do we want to think about our user research plan approach and eventually the findings that we get from it, right? And that's where sort of we
Just a quick question.
The entire discovery process. And
can you hear me, by the way?
I'm not.
Sorry?
Yes, I can.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I think when I mute myself and then I unmute, for some reason, it doesn't work quite correctly. But just a quick question on the pages part there. Does that mean specific pages are in on the website, specific pages in the app? Is that what that refers to?
Yeah, there are. So we don't necessarily have teams focusing on pages, but then, you know, if you think about it from like a KTLO standpoint, like keep the lights on, there are teams that some teams focus on the upper funnel pages, some teams focus on the lower funnel pages. So for instance, my team has pages like PDP, cart, checkout, and receipt. So if anyone's doing anything on PDP, cart, and checkout, I need to be sort of getting involved to be consulted, informed, and supported. And those are some of the specifics that we sort of call out here.
Okay, interesting. And I really like the at the top part of the document where you talk about the emotion.
Yep.
How does a certain job make people feel? So what in an online furniture context, what would be the types of emotions that you might want customers to feel, and how do you achieve those?
Yeah. So for instance, let me give you an example of, let's say you go to Wayfair, you make a purchase, and then you're expecting the product to come home in 2 or 3 days, right? So within those 2 or 3 days, you are probably going to want to come back to the app and check what the order status is, for instance, right? So how do we make that order status easily available on the app so that anytime you just come on the app, it's super intuitive, it's top of the page for you to look at it, to eventually understand if there's been any changes to the delivery, or if there's any, like, is the status still holding true, right? So when you see that, and if everything's intact, which is usually the case, you feel a lot more relaxed about your order coming on time and reaching on time, right? So how do we drive that emotion of making you feel relaxed and making you feel less anxious about some of these large parcel orders that come is one emotion that we want to take care of for the consumer and not have that be a challenge for the consumer.
Ooh, yeah, that's a really nice example like that. Do you want to carry on?
Yeah, I'm not going to spend too much time on the delivery. I mean, this is where, you know, obviously experience design plays a massive role in the discovery side too, but then you kind of call it in the discovery phase or delivery phase, but we start to iterate on some of the initial designs, and then we go through some iterations of user testing as well with that. And then this is where we sort of get into like the engineering manager kind of coming in and taking on the role of like, okay, now that we know the what and the why is defined, the user research is done, the designs are in place, let's start to look at some high-level technical designs to see, the feasibility and the viability. And of course, we're doing a lot of this in parallel. I don't want to make it feel like this is waterfall. We bring in the technical teams very, very early on in the process. In fact, in the initial idea kickoff or the opportunity kickoff, we bring in all the technical stakeholders too, because it's super important to bring the tech folks along on the journey and make sure we're taking that inputs into consideration. But this technical design is, once we know that the idea is feasible, viable at the high level, how do we sort of start drilling down into some of the low-level designs and stuff like that, right? And then we sort of also look at like the experimentation approach and plan in terms of, it's this the pre-post test or an A-B test or an A-B-C test? How do we want to plan that? What are the metrics and duration and things like that? What does the control experience, variant experience look like and things like that? We also have a massive analytics tagging and tracking plan, because we want to make sure like we're measuring the engagement aspects of the experience and looking at that. And then some basic stuff, right? Like effort estimation, milestones, risks, and stakeholders, basically.
I really like that you've called out analytics and tracking as a separate section, because it's one of those areas that sometimes can be forgotten. And particularly in large organizations, often there's work to be done to ensure that you can track and tag the performance of whatever you've released. I think it often gets over, like you may start off with a document like this or on your strategy, say, yeah, here are the metrics that we'll measure this feature by. But actually, you also sometimes have to do the work to ensure that the tagging set up and that you're able to measure those metrics properly. So I think calling that out separately is actually a really neat idea. And hopefully people can get some value out of that as well.
Yeah, no, that's such a good call out, Richard, because that's one thing that I as a PM have been like, I've evolved the most. I almost, when I think about a certain idea or an opportunity, when I think about the North Star primary metrics, I immediately, like once we nail down the user research and the designs, I immediately get to the tracking, because you want to make sure that your tracking is able to tie back to the North Star metrics and the primary and the secondary metrics. Because if that doesn't happen, how do you even measure what you're doing is viable or scalable, or this can be taken to MVP plus one or not, depending on how MVP has done, right? So super, super critical that we nail down the specifics of the analytics tracking and tracking.
Yeah, I think it's that's a really good call out. Perfect. And so this, was there anything else on this document?
No. Perfect. No, I mean, the last thing was just FAQs, both internal and external, a little bit of the Amazon model there in terms of like making sure every stakeholder understands from both the internal and an external perspective.
Okay, awesome. And with a document like this, so you call it a product review document, do you? At what level would you create a document like this for? You know, we talked about the different squad structures, talked about strategy and, you know, OKRs and things like that. But when would you decide, okay, do you know what, this piece of work or this feature requires a product review document? What's your thought process that goes into, you know, deciding whether or not it justifies creating this or not?
Yeah, no, great question, right? I mean, every squad is sort of going to work in the mental model of three things, right? One is you want to keep the lights on, want to make sure like bugs are handled, stability, performance, crashes, and things like that are taken care of. So you obviously don't do any document of this sort for that component. The second component is new enhancements, right? Like there's already existing feature, you want to tweak a few things, you want to take it to the next level. And the third component is like a brand new feature, right? So either the second or the third component, the way you decide when you need to do a comprehensive PR or a product review document is, I like to put it in like a 2x2 matrix, wherein on one axis you have the business impact and on the second axis you have the customer impact. Whenever I see the opportunity to say that there is a high customer impact in terms of experiences that we're changing, and wherever the business impact is high, there's a definite need for a PR document. If the customer impact and the business impact are also medium, I would still consider doing it. Maybe not at the level of depth and breadth you would when it's high and high. But if the customer impact is super low, business impact is super low, it's not that risky. You got to really think about, do you want to spend all that time on this? Or would you rather like just spend a few days coding it and putting it out in front of the customers and seeing what kind of comes out? So it's a lot of value of the time that you spend in doing this versus just getting results as early as possible. So a little bit to do with the risk in terms of business impact and customer impact and the time that it takes to eventually ship the feature out.
Perfect. Yeah, that makes complete sense, because as you say, you wouldn't spend a lot of time for business as usual stuff or stuff that's already been shipped that you just want to tweak. You probably wouldn't go through this comprehensive process. But it's very new features and for bigger things, higher impact.
I think that's reasonable. There may be some cases where even if you want to make a small enhancement, let's say it may look small on the outset, but the business impact could be pretty massive and the customer impact could be pretty reasonable. And like I said, you would still think about it, maybe not as comprehensive, like a 6-pager or something like this, maybe just a 1-pager to make sure all the stakeholders are sort of aligned and aware about it.
Yeah, perfect. And you're using Google Docs for this? Is that what you typically use internally as well?
Yeah, so we're a Google Suite company. Okay. So everything's on Google, like Google Drive, Google Spreadsheets, Google Slides, and Google Docs.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, perfect. Yeah, that's really, really helpful. Should we move on to your second product in your product stack?
Yep, let's do it. So my second stack is what we call as a product review deck. So I know there may be a question right away to chart, like, what's the difference between the product review document and the product review deck? I mean, given that we're in such an online furniture and online, like, we're all about experiences, there's a lot of features that we do, which is hard to explain in terms of the visuals on a document. The document initially serves as a way to get initial stakeholder alignment. But then what we eventually do is we use a deck to sort of take it to the next level of leaders sometimes too. You know, if you're especially presenting it to folks at like director plus VP or even C-suite sometimes, depending on the scale of the feature, we try to put that in the form of like a deck, which ideally takes a lot of the content that's already in the product review document that I just shared, but then it eventually puts it in the form of a leadership style presentation. And then we ideally go after these questions, right? Again, talking a little bit about like, what is the problem or the opportunity that we're going after? And we try to answer a lot of these questions as its own individual slide decks. Like, what is exactly the problem? Why is it worth solving? What could the solution look like? How do we forecast the outcomes? And what do we want to learn, right, in terms of the learning agenda? And then here's where we dive a lot more into some of the solutioning space as well. You know, in the product review document, there may just be another document that we link out to for the technical plan or the user research plan. And that gets into a lot of detail with each technical plan, user research plan, analytics plan, or the designs. But when you need to present something to like directors, VPs, and C-suite, like I said, it's not easy to do that in a document, right? I mean, the document helps you with stakeholder alignment initially, but this deck is used as a way for us to present and gain any sort of inputs or feedback. And this is what we do as part of a ritual that we have called as the product review meeting, where we do this meeting once in a couple of weeks. We get a slot of 45 minutes to 50 minutes where the PM takes the first 5 minutes to set the context of the opportunity and allows people 15 minutes to read through the entire deck in that meeting. And people can put in comments on the deck as questions, clarifications, inputs, feedback, perspectives. And then over the next 40 minutes in that meeting, we take the time to go after each comment and address those questions. And in any deep dives, we basically take it as an offline conversation or a parking lot conversation. And at the end of that meeting, we also have a feedback form where people can give us a sense of like, if they were the way we ask that question is, if you were the PM on this feature, given all the context, the risks and the outcomes we're expecting and the hypothesis we're going after, would you still ship this feature? Under what circumstance do you not ship this? And as a customer, do you resonate with this feature, right? So we try to get a pulse check. I mean, there's usually like 30, 40 people in this product review meeting. So it's a lot of good data points across the team. So hopefully this gives you a little bit of the difference of the deck versus the document.
Yeah, definitely. This is really useful. And you mentioned that there's a 15-minute window where people can add comments to the document. Does that mean, you know, the meeting starts and then you perhaps give some context at the beginning and then you just take a pause for 15 minutes and let everyone add their comments? Is that how it works? Or do people prepare before the meeting?
That's correct. So we actually ship the deck to folks 24 hours, 48 hours before. So you could definitely have a pre-read and start to put comments. But okay. I mean, just how busy everyone is, it sometimes may not happen for everyone to have taken a look. But that's where in the meeting, I usually go in and say, hey, here's the opportunity. Here's the executive summary. And here's your 15 minutes. And everybody turns their camera off. We give 15 minutes. And then once people start turning their camera on, we then start diving into the comments and go through the questions and answers there.
That's a really neat way of doing it. How do you find that? How does that work for you? How do you find that as a process? Does it work for you? Does it work well? Or are there things you'd like to improve with that? I can imagine some people are super engaged, but maybe other people don't bother engaging. I don't know. How does it work?
That's true. But I think largely what we have found is, I think the fact that we give everybody 15 minutes time in that meeting, there's a higher chance for people to focus on the content in that deck at that time than at any other point. Even if you send it as a preview, there's a high chance they may not do it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you give them that 15 minutes dedicated, and if they potentially showed up to that meeting, that means this is important. So there's a higher chance that they may actually look at the deck. That we have found so far is, for instance, the last two or three product review meetings that we've done, on average, every meeting has actually ran over by 2 or 3 minutes because there's been a lot of questions and a lot of engaging conversations. So we, in fact, in the feedback form asked, what do you think about this format of the meeting? Does it resonate? And what would you rate it on a scale of 1 to 5? And I think we got a high 4 what people thought about the format of that meeting.
And how do you find it personally? I can imagine this can be quite nerve-wracking if you're just walking into a room, virtual room, and you just, you know, you're sat there with a bunch of important people and they all chip in with their opinions and their questions. I guess it can be quite tough at times.
It is. It's definitely nerve-wracking, but I think this is where the the leaders have done a great job in our company where they set the environment up to be very safe and ensure that, you know, and it's not just me as a PM responding to all these questions too, right? I mean, I bring in my analytics folks, my engineering manager, my UXR, my design person. So I predominantly try to take a stab at it, but then I try to call on these people to also give their SME expertise. And when there are times, if anyone is not able to take on that question, I mean, that's the job of a PM to sort of fill in, right? And it takes a couple of reps. But at the end of the day, if you go into this meeting looking at this as an opportunity to get feedback, get perspective, I think it's great. And at the end of the day, you're the PM. You make the decision to ship it or not. It's not a group decision. It's a group perspective, but it's not a group decision, right? So it's okay for you to feel a little bit anxious, but I think one or two reps, you'll be totally fine in these meetings.
Perfect. Yeah, that's really, really useful. Thanks very much for showing us the kind of visual alternative to the product review template that you showed us previously. Cool. So shall we now move on to your final product? Or final part of your product, right?
Yep, let me do that. Yeah, I mean, this is a little bit simple one. So this is when we have a concept called as release notes that we send out when we launch the feature or the test so that everybody is aware of when it went out and stuff. So we call this the software release note. We basically let everybody know what's the scope of this, what's the summary and the impact, both from a business and a customer perspective, what exactly is the hypothesis that we're testing, and what are some next steps as quick follow-ups. We give them a little bit of sense of like feature toggles that we have used for this, just in case something goes wrong, we are ready to pull it out. When was this released? We talk a little bit about like, what does the control and the variant screenshots look like for iOS and Android? If it's an A/B test, if it's different kinds of tests, we provide different kinds of detail. We do have a recognition here so that, you know, most of the leaders, even VP level folks, are constantly looking at these release notes because this is their way to know what's going to go on and what things are being shipped. It's always nice to recognize folks for the kind of work they do. And then if folks have questions, they can always reach out to some of the contact folks. So this is more of an awareness creation because you don't want anybody to be caught by surprise because everybody uses the Wayfair app, even in our company, and they don't want to see an experience where, oh my God, like when does this go live? I have no idea about it, right? So this is just more sort of awareness and just helps everybody be aligned on what's going on within the company. So just thought I'll kind of wrap it up with this as my third product stack.
Perfect. And does this get sent out at the end of every sprint cycle, or do you just make a decision, you know, based on what you've released, whether it justifies a dedicated release note?
Yeah, so not every feature or not, I mean, so for like, we do weekly releases, like every Monday our app new releases go out. If it's just bug fixes and small enhancements and performance stability, things that we take care of, we don't do release notes. But if it's a new test that we're launching, new enhancement that we have made, we usually send out, even if it's a small feature, because I think at the end of the day, everybody needs to be aware of what's going on in the company. And this is the way for them to also know that.
Yeah, perfect. And do you send anything similar to your users as well? Or is this just internal?
This is just purely internal.
Okay, because there's new products now on the market, which are, I'm trying to think, there's one called Launch Notes, I think, and there's a couple of others which are dedicated just to release note management. So they connect with like Jira and stuff like that, and they can push out release notes to internal stakeholders and also to your users. And I think it's quite a nice touch to almost have like a release blog or release log for your users and then potentially email them as well when you've released something that impacts them, right?
I know, that's interesting. I mean, I should totally take a look at it.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting niche, but you know, yep. Working in product, you realize that sometimes this it can be quite time consuming to put together things like release notes. So any way you can automate that is the best, you know, is good.
Totally.
Perfect. So yeah, that's really, really helpful. And aside from the three areas that you've highlighted for us today, are there any other tools or products that you personally use that, you know, as a PM, you think you really couldn't live without? So we've had some people say they couldn't live without pen and paper. Some people have said, you know, they couldn't live without the cloud because, you know, the fact that everything gets synced up in the cloud is something that we just take for granted. And we've had some people who said, you know, they couldn't live without Jira because they use it for their own personal productivity. So is there anything that you personally use, aside from the areas we've touched upon today, that, you know, on a day-to-day basis that you really couldn't live without as a PM?
Oh, it's got to be Slack, right?
Okay.
We'll We live on Slack. Decisions get made on Slack. Emails are barely used in Mather.
Yeah.
Everything in the product organizations happen on Slack, all the way from like analyst level folks to like the senior most people.
Do you have
Jira and
when it comes to Slack, how what is your Slack etiquette and what is your Slack setup? So some people use, so we spoke to Suji at LinkedIn and she was, you know, she talked us through all the different hacks that she has for Slack, you know, setting reminders, setting alerts for keywords, using the personal blogging and note tracking tool. Are there any unique ways that you use Slack that you'd like to share with us, or is it mostly just communicating with colleagues?
I think we use it mostly for communicating with colleagues, but I also am very categorical in terms of what channels are muted and not muted, because otherwise it can just overwhelm you in terms of the notifications that come out on Slack. So you want to be very thoughtful about it. Second is we use workflows quite a bit, wherein, you know, if any team wants to make a request to my team, there's like instead of doing a Google form, we have a Slack workflow where we ask them like, what team are you in? What channel? What issue you want us to solve? Why is this important? Where does this stand in the priority and things like that? And we use that for tracking purposes and just brings a lot of visibility and ownership. We also have like, you know, before folks want to put something out in our Slack channels for help, we have a daily reminder that goes out on Slack and says, if your issue is in this category, this component, don't reach out to us, but reach out to this team. If it's here, then reach out to us. But before you reach out to us, do these five things, right? So we kind of remind and educate folks because we mostly want qualified input and demand coming to us so that we spend more time on that rather than on like trying to help people go where they need to go. So their daily reminders on Slack are going to help them a lot. And most of the initiatives or effects that we work on, we just create like temporary channels where we bring like 40, 50 people together on these channels to coordinate. We do have a program management practice, but more often than not, a lot of the product features and enhancements that we work on, we don't necessarily have program management support. So the product managers sort of act as a program managers. And just having Slack makes life so much easier. Otherwise, you got to like just set up like 10 meetings. Instead, you can have like one Slack channel that you can keep it private or public and just get all through the execution side of things.
Perfect. Yeah. So it's always interesting to see how different companies and different people use Slack and tailor it for their own needs. Perfect. So yeah, thank you very much, Vic, for spending some time with us today to talk through your product stack at Wayfair. If people want to, you know, follow you or keep in touch, do you have a LinkedIn profile or a Twitter profile? Where's the best place that people can reach you?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. So you can find me on LinkedIn as Vikram Bharat. So if you just type Vikram Bharat Vaj Wayfair, I believe I'm the only one. I don't know, maybe. But you should definitely find me there. I'm also on Twitter as at Vikram Bharadwaj. So right now I'm super following a couple of folks there. Super interesting in the product community of what happens on Twitter. So yeah, feel free to reach out to me on either LinkedIn or Twitter, but preferably LinkedIn.
Perfect. Brilliant. Thanks very much for taking part.
Yeah. Thanks, Richard. Thanks for having me.